Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode, I was joined by Ian Kerner, a nationally recognized sex therapist and licensed psychotherapist, to talk about the role of sex in long-term relationships. Ian works with both individuals and couples on a range of relational issues that often lead to distress. He's regularly quoted as an expert in the media, with recent features in the New York Times, The Economist, and CNN. Ian is the New York Times best-selling author of She Comes First, as well as So Tell Me About the Last Time You Had Sex. We start this episode in the bedroom by looking at common problems faced by long-term couples. Ian addresses the idea of intimacy waning and losing attraction for your partner. He offers practical tools you can use to spice up your relationship. We also talk about the impact of external factors such as children and how to know if your relationship is past the point of repair. This is a great episode if you're trying to decide whether this is simply a rough patch or it really is the end of the road. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. Welcome, Ian.
Hello, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Well, it feels like we're joined by a true expert in all that is sex and relationships. So I'm really looking forward to digging into this one.
Great. Me too.
And it's lovely to have you with us. And obviously, there's a big time difference. So thank you for joining us. We're especially grateful. So I guess I'd like to start. So this podcast is all about divorce and separation. And we know that one of the perhaps most common areas of disagreement in a marriage can be sex and sexual intimacy. And lots of times people come to us divorcing saying that a big issue is the sex in the relationship. So from your perspective, in terms of what you hear, what are the most common problems that couples in a long-term relationship have around sex?
Yeah, I think the number one problem that I see in my office would be desire discrepancy, where one partner is much more interested in sex than the other. And so there's mismatched libido. Now, within that, there can be a number of factors beyond that. Very often, there is no longer an emotional intimacy in the relationship. Very often, there isn't trust in the relationship. Sometimes there's always been a sexual problem in the relationship that's never been addressed that diminishes the value and the motivation to have sex. So I think there's a lot of issues that sort of culminate, especially in long-term relationships, in a lack of interest in sex and just being overwhelmed by everything else that we have to deal with in our lives, you know, being parents, managing the household, our jobs. We really lose what I call our sexual selves in the relationship.
Yeah. And I guess I always think it's quite sad. There seems to be so many things that can go wrong in a relationship, but sex feels like an ultimately quite a fixable one. Am I being naive here or have I just been lucky?
Sex is very fixable. I mean, you can work on your sex life if you're able to communicate about your sex life. And that's a big if, because I think many people go into a relationship feeling like sex is just something that's spontaneous. It's based on chemistry. You shouldn't have to work at it. You shouldn't have to talk about it. And when it comes to talking about it, it often triggers enormous shame or avoidance or embarrassment. So something that could be quite easy, I'm not saying in all cases, but something that could be easy to talk about at least and to dig into and to work on the way we work on other relationship issues often lacks the basis for communication. But I also want to say, I think that there are many times where sex is the hardest thing to fix in a relationship and the other things might be easier.
I guess when you say it all comes down to communication, we hear that so often in the work that we do with divorcing and separating couples. It's always about whether or not you can communicate and articulate your needs and your wants and your, I guess, ultimately your desires. How do you know
if sex is fixable within a relationship, what are the sorts of things that you are saying or doing that indicates that actually the relationship isn't at an end, but really you need to go and see somebody like you rather than actually say, you know what, this has become so insurmountable, this is it?
Absolutely. So when is sex fixable? When there's still attraction in the relationship. You know, I find it's always helpful if couples, you know, pick their life partners thinking about romantic attraction, sexual attraction, physical attraction. Very often people leave that off the table and prioritize other characteristics that they think that should be important in a relationship. So hopefully if there's still some core attraction, hopefully if a couple is still able to have fun together and to go out together and to show up outside of the bedroom, if they have a basis of being able to talk about other different difficult topics and have surmounted obstacles, if they're making an attempt to still have sex and for some reason not succeeding, or even if one partner feels still very strongly about wanting to get back to a sexual place and has the motivation to do that and can sort of pass on or bestow some of that motivation to their partner. So I think that there's lots of times, and quite honestly, Kate, most of the couples that I work with who are in long-term relationships who are dealing with desire discrepancy, often what's needed is really just the opportunity to come in and talk about what's going on, to not feel embarrassed, and to figure out how to reprioritize sex and to get a formulation of what's happening in the relationship. So luckily, most of the couples I work with do go on to sort of repair and restore.
I guess in that sex discrepancy, is that a conversation you can have between yourselves? Or do you think, you know, those conversations will always work better when there's a professional in the room?
You know, I think in the case of desire, it is important sometimes to have a professional in the room because we have so many stereotypes around desire. And it's very easy to say to one partner, oh, you're no longer a sexual person, or you used to be sexual. What happened? Now you're just no interest. And it's very easy for somebody to say to the other partner, all you think about is sex without thinking about other parts of the relationship. It's always sex, sex, sex. That's the only thing that matters. I just feel objectified. So I think that people bring a lot of internalized stereotypes around desire. So one thing that I often do in my work is to say, you know, this isn't really about a low desire partner and a high desire partner. It's really about two people who haven't established a common desire framework. And it's very often it's quite common for each partner to have to be in a different desire framework, as I just said. For one partner, very often heterosexual relationships, it would be the male partner who still experiences desire in what I call a highly reactive way, or what gets called spontaneous desire. What that means is, for the high desire partner, for the male who is experiencing spontaneous desire, he can still get aroused and turned on very quickly. He could still see his partner or get a sexual cue and feel sexual desire in his body and then be frustrated by being rejected or by not having desire. So it's very easy for a spontaneous desire partner to live with a lot of internal frustration. It's also quite common for that spontaneous desire partner to be paired with a partner who is often the female partner in the relationship. I don't want to overgeneralize, but that partner is often in what we would call a responsive desire framework or a more deliberative framework, meaning they don't experience desire spontaneously. It's not the first thing that they experience. It's like the third or the fourth thing that they experience. And there needs to be a set of preconditions to get to desire. And what that is there needs to be an overall environment that's conducive to generating the kind of arousal that would lead to the emergence of desire. And that has everything to do with the ratio of stressors to exciters that exist in the environment. So you'll hear, to just make this simple, you'll hear many men say, yeah, I can pivot, I can get turned on, I could be working on something and then go straight to sex. And you'll hear a lot of women say, there's no way I can arrive at sex when I have a laundry list of things that still need to get done, where I have a level of anxiety or stress that's going on. So that's a big difference in desire frameworks. And it's really about working together to create a shared framework that's really a sex positive environment.
But that sounds like a real challenge, because who doesn't have a laundry list of jobs on their mind like 99% of the time? So how do you get to that point where you can create that environment? What are the steps then to help people create an environment where the less cued person can actually feel they want to have that kind of sexual contact?
So absolutely. So this ties into a question that I'm sometimes asked, which is, how often should we be having sex?
And I know, I was trying not to be that crude and ask, but that's, I guess that so many people want to know that. You read so much conflicting advice. You don't have to have any, you have to have it at least twice a day. And you just like, where do you pitch yourself?
And it's important to your answer. So I believe that it is a hard question to answer, and it's very qualitative and individual. But I do believe that couples should be trying to have sex once a week when they're in long-term relationships. And studies have shown that couples in long-term relationships who do have sex once a week have higher levels of overall relationship positivity. Now, the couples who had sex 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times a week, which I think are quite rare, do not necessarily have higher levels of relationship positivity than the couples who had sex once a week. But the couples who do have sex once a week definitely have higher overall levels of relationship positivity than the couples who are having sex every other week, every month, every 6 months. So first thing that I want to establish is, let's create a ritual where you're having sex once a week, right? Now, some people are very adverse to the idea of scheduling sex once a week. But come on, we are in busy relationships. We schedule everything down to the minute. So let's schedule this, please. There's no way to be spontaneous if every other minute of your life is scheduled. So let's pick, and I ask them if possible, to pick a night that can be your sex night. And let's just say it's going to end up being a Friday night or a Saturday night, a weekend night. What I will ask couples to do, and I always give homework and I always space my sessions out by 2 to 3 weeks so that there's an opportunity for couples to really do this more than once, is I say, wake up that morning and live the day knowing that you're going to get to sex at the end of the day and you want to get to sex at the end of the day. How are you going to live your life differently? Now, I don't mean take the day off or, you know, go off on some jaunt. What I literally mean is, will you have gotten a good night's sleep? Will you wake up and talk to each other and be nice and have a morning coffee potentially? Will you do your job in a way, if it's a Friday, in which you're not coming home with a ton of work? Will you get to the gym if it's important for you to feel good in your body? Will you have even taken care of yourself and showered and done whatever you need to do? Will you pitch in and collaborate on the chores and the childcare and whatever needs to happen? Will you end up going out and actually having some fun together and having a glass of wine and a nice dinner if that's your thing? Will you have cleared the time to be able to come home, to be able to be sexual? What will you have changed incrementally in your life that will lead to that positive sexual connection? So I hope that sort of answers the question about how I help couples sort of manage the ratio between stressors and exciters and to find a healthy balance.
Because even as you, because when you say stressors and exciters, it's abstract. But then when you go on and explain it in that way, you can start to feel the kind of excitement build as you're talking through the day and what you'll have done differently. It's really fascinating.
Thank you. What I did just now was I emphasized minimizing the stressors. And let me just say, you also want to emphasize the exciters. So I mentioned things like going to the gym and feeling good in your body or getting a good sleep or going out and having a fun date night. But I think couples that succeed sexually also maintain in their relationships what I call the erotic thread, which is the space in between sexual events. You don't just show up for sex and have sex. You show up
and then forget it. Yeah.
Right. You show up as a sexual person. And so what does that mean? It means you need to find during the week or in that interval opportunities to flirt with each other, opportunities to be physical, opportunities to be a little dirty, a little nasty, a little raunchy, to go into that kind of sexual space where we want to express our sexual appetites or feel wanted and desired by our partner, right? So we want to build up some actual sexual tension. And so that's on the exciter side of the thing, you know? And then what is going to make sex exciting? Is it going to be just having the time and showing up for the sex that you know is going to be good? Does it mean actually having to talk about the sex? Because if I'm going to do all this stuff during the day to get to sex at the end of the day, it better be decent enough sex. What do we need to do to get there as well?
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because the way you describe it like that and the build up, it's got its own joy, like you say, that's threaded throughout the relationship, not just around the scheduling part of, well, it's 9 o'clock on a Friday night. Okay, now let's have an early night. It threads itself throughout the relationship throughout the week, which I guess is what you're saying is the point about how sex is more than just about the moment you have it and more about ticking off to say you've done it once a week. It's about the impact it has on the rest of the relationship. That's the key.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I was working with a couple not too long ago, and the guy was complaining about, we never have sex. And the wife actually said, you know, we actually do have sex once a week. We do sometimes even more than that. So I don't know what you're expecting or how you can complain. And what he actually ended up saying is, you know, you're right, but it's not about the sex. I don't feel like I'm wanted in this relationship. Like, I don't feel like a sexually desired or wanted person. And when we show up for sex, it feels a little perfunctory. So he wasn't even really talking about the sex, even though that's how he positioned it. He was talking about feeling desired in the relationship. And that's something that I find quite a bit in all partners, and it's universal, is wanting to feel desired, right? Not just showing up for sex, but actually wanting to be desired. And sometimes that's much more important than the sex itself.
What I was going to say is exactly that point. So that losing attraction, that losing that spark, that attractiveness, that feels like an inevitability in so many relationships. And it's often what allows, once that part of it's gone, it allows all the other stuff to come sort of crashing in and start undermining the relationship. Is it inevitable? Are we always going to lose our attractiveness to each other? Or can we rebuild that? How do you stay attracted after, I don't know, 40 or 30 or 50 years?
Yeah, I mean, I've been 25 years, so I haven't been yet 30 or 40 or 50. I've been married, and levels of attraction are still, I would say, relatively high and satisfying. And, you know, what does that come down to? It comes down to a few things. One, my wife and I picked each other, factoring in a high degree of physical chemistry and sexual chemistry. I think a lot of couples, and at least what I'm seeing in my practice here in the States, with a lot of couples who are getting married and they're in, say, their late 20s or mid 30s, suddenly they're not thinking about sexual attraction or physical attraction. They're just thinking about, is this person a good mate? Will this person make a good mother or father? Are they doing well at work? Are we compatible? Do we travel well together? So I do think it is important to pick with that fundamental kind of charge. And I think that that is very, very hard to find or to create if it wasn't there in the first place. That said, there have been periods in my own marriage where attraction, you know, has been lower. And what has that been about? That's been about feeling disconnected. That's been about not having fun as a couple anymore. That's been about resentments around distribution of labor coming into the picture. That's been around trust and emotional intimacy, and it's been around a lack of regard for one's own, you know, physical state of attractiveness. You know, during COVID here in the pandemic, you know, people were walking around in their pajamas, they weren't showering, they were eating, they were gaining weight, they weren't exercising. You know, it's just not attractive. And so we have to sort of think about maintaining across all of those dimensions.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing about it is, which is interesting what you say, everything seems more head-driven at the moment, doesn't it? Like you said, people are picking people in quite a determined way because of their genetics or because of, you know, their prospects and that kind of thing. And that sort of guttural, instinctual, just desire for desire's sake seems to be a little bit less, less prevalent in our society. I think there's a bit of a cultural shift, isn't there, to successful relationships based on a much more sort of head-based rather than heart-based kind of place.
Or genital-based, to be honest, too. You know, heart and body, you know. And yeah, you know, it's funny, like I wrote an article for CNN about this because across the last couple of years, I've had at least 10 people come into my practice and say, you know, when I was picking my partner, I made a list of all the characteristics I was looking for in a husband or a wife. And number 1 through 5, sexual attraction or sex was not on the list, but that's what they're coming to see me about now. And I would say, like, why would that not have been part of why you were picking your partner? That's the one thing you're going to be doing together that's going to make you, you know, more than just roommates or parents or business partners. And a lot of people will say, well, you stop having sex in a marriage anyway. You know, they have a belief that you stop having sex anyway. Married people stop having sex, don't have sex. Or we'll work on it. That will come. We'll just work on that hard and that attraction will eventually emerge. Some people will say, you just can't have sex and partnership all in the same person. You can't have the hot sex and the good partner. They don't come together. And they'll say, I've had my sexual experiences. They were crazy. They were wild. And especially, I think, in an age of hookup culture and dating apps, people have had a lot of sex and they've had a lot of interesting sex and crazy sex. And so a lot of people will say, I just wanted some safety, some security, some calmness. I wasn't thinking about sex.
So it sounds like sex as part of a long-term relationship isn't necessarily a priority because you can get sex elsewhere. And lots of people have had, as you were saying, sex elsewhere before they come to thinking about a long-term relationship. So it's not the priority. But what you're saying is actually that's what's going to keep the glue going and hold the long-term relationship together.
You know, everybody is different, but I'm, you know, here in New York running my practice, and I believe that sexual attraction is a glue that helps keep couples together, and having that sex once a week and maintaining that erotic thread throughout the week really does contribute to a healthy, positive relationship.
What about people who've been divorced then? If you've been divorced, you've had a sexual partner already, at least one, and you're now divorced and back out there again. To what extent does sexual baggage come into relationships like second, third, fourth time round? What happens in those scenarios?
Well, what I've found in those scenarios when someone is getting on the other side of a divorce or separation, I found a couple of things. Sometimes someone is just so ready to be sexual. They've been repressed. They've been, you know, held back. They're really charged up and ready. I have a number of patients who have been in sexually inert relationships for years now, and they're ready and they're excited. Then you have people who are nervous and scared. How am I going to navigate this world of apps? I'm 20 years older since the last time I looked for a sexual partner. I haven't had an orgasm with a partner in 10 years. There's a lot of beliefs. It's mainly about limiting beliefs and sort of reframing those limiting beliefs into opportunities. But look, we stay sexual until the day we die. The highest rate of sexually transmitted infections is in retirement homes and amongst senior citizens. So we are all...
Wow.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, at least here in the States. So we are all sexual people and we can all get back in there and get turned on.
So when you're going for like post-divorce sex, do you think there are some things to be more wary of or cognizant of? How do you get back on the horse if you have, as you said, been in a relationship where perhaps you haven't been having regular sex with a partner?
Yeah, I mean, I work with a lot of single people, divorced people, you know, on getting onto dating apps and creating a profile and, you know, stepping into the shallow end, figuring out strategies for going out with friends and meeting people. I caution people around safe sex and STIs, even if they're past their childbearing years, you know, speaking to women. I think, again, a lot of people are afraid because we've been living in an age of porn where it seems like sex itself may have changed somehow. You know, everyone's out there doing really kinky stuff and having sex like porn stars and just feels not like the sex that I grew up having. And that's not true. I've worked with thousands of couples on helping them maximize what I call their sex script, the behaviors that they engage in during a sexual event. And there are really only about 12 common behaviors that people in general engage in, you know, including intercourse. But they're just things like cuddling and holding each other and kissing and manual stimulation and oral stimulation. So it's not like sex has been reinvented in a way in which you're on the other side of an ice age or something trying to come into a new world. So again, it's really just about helping people work around their limiting beliefs.
I guess, so sex is all in the mind in that sense then, isn't it? Really quite genuinely about helping people with the, because I think there's something around helping people with the language of it as well, you know, like how you talk about sex, how you say what you want and what you don't want, how you put your own boundaries in the heat of the moment. I think all of that becomes quite overwhelming when you haven't been having sex for quite a long time for people. How do you help them do that? Do you have to talk about it before you do it? I guess I'm asking.
Yeah, you're talking about the psychological aspects of arousal in some ways, the talking about sex. And there's two kinds of talk that we engage in. One is the kind of talk where we're just expressing our needs. Hey, do you have a condom, or are there any STIs we should be talking about? Or I'm not ready for this, or I don't like that, or that feels like it a little hurtful or ticklish, right? There's ways in which we need to just communicate about sex. And then we also have to understand that sexual language is sexy. It can turn us on. We want to feel desired, right? We want to verbalize or be verbalized with during sex around how delicious and scrumptious it all is. We want to be able to go into that kind of, you know, sexual language. So I help couples develop, you know, both those dimensions of sexual communication. And we can talk about how, but, you know, I think that there's two dimensions to communicating effectively around sex.
And do you think when you're older and you're divorced and you've perhaps not been having that regular kind of communication, is that something you've got to just learn? And how do you find out about this stuff? Like, do you have to go and see a sex therapist, or how do you do it?
There's also YouTube videos, and there's, you know, I've written, you know, books on this topic, and there are books specifically on communication. I mean, I have, when it comes to communicating about sex and the kind of sex that you like or don't like, or what you want or don't want sexually from a partner, what I try and do is just emphasize non-defensive communication and to really think about making positive bids for attention and to really recognize if we're triggering a partner's defenses a little bit and being able to say, oh, wait, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you angry. I'm just expressing my own desires, or I'm expressing my passions, or what I like, you know, to try and communicate from emotions that are inviting and sexy and not that trigger defenses. So I think sex is an area where it's very easy to become guarded, and we have to watch out for that. I also encourage people who are, let's say, getting back into sex or in sexual relationships and just want to have better sex or want to have different sex. Maybe they're missing oral sex as part of their sexual menu. What I'll say to them is, you know, think about a fantasy of the kind of sex that you'd like to have, you know, break it into its components, you know, tell your partner, boy, did I have a sexy dream last night? And, you know, hopefully your partner will be interested in what was in that sexy dream, and just describe a sexy scenario. It doesn't have to be a kinky scenario. It doesn't have to be the sex you've never had. Maybe it's just the sex you're having with a few modifications, but describe a sexy scenario. And if you want to say you had a dream so that it came from your unconscious, you know, go ahead and do that.
Well, that's quite a good tool, isn't it? Or quite a good technique to weave in, because I think that's quite a difficult conversation to start. Now, I always think this is the hardest bit. If you're worrying about sex, or you're thinking about sex, or there's something not right with sex in your relationship, how do you bring it up without it feeling like a big deal, or without the other person immediately closing down because they're immediately on the defensive about it? That is an interesting technique, but are there any others? How do you have the difficult conversation about sex? Where do you start?
What I want to say is, if you have an opportunity to start, start. And if you're at the beginning of a relationship, please start, because the more you embed honest communication into your relationship, the better off you're going to be in every aspect of your relationship. But, you know, good relationships are the ones where someone can say without shame, ow, that hurt a little bit this time. Or, you know, no, I didn't have an orgasm that time, but it's really okay. Or, you know, I really want to shift things up and do something sexy and different, right? If you've just embedded that kind of conversation into the relationship at the beginning, it's going to make it so much easier going forward. Otherwise, you know, you're looking at having a big conversation that you've been avoiding having for a while. And A, that might be a time to go see a sex therapist. I'd like to tell everyone that's listening to you that sometimes couples only come to me for one session, right? That's all they needed, was just to start the conversation. I'm not talking about intensive long-term therapy. I'm talking sometimes about one or two or three sessions. But like any big conversation, they're not easy to have.
You're the ultimate conversation starter then, aren't you? Because I guess that's part of what you're trying to do, is embed that as a normal, natural part of people's relationship routine, aren't they? To have these conversations. And if you've not had them or not been having them, I guess you just need it modeling, don't you? You need some safe ins with a therapist to then get it working.
Yeah, you need some modeling, you need some scaffolding. But what I want to say to everybody is that many of my couples that I work with are a little uncomfortable in the beginning, because I really do get directly into, you know, the heart of the matter. But everyone comes out feeling relieved, feeling able to talk about this stuff, feeling like they've been able to open up a new dimension of conversation. So it's really about breaking the ice on a difficult conversation. And so if you don't have access to, you know, a sex therapist, which or counselor, which many people do not, just think about breaking the ice. And I kind of want to promise that if you do so in a way that's inviting, that's not triggering defensiveness, that you'll have a positive result and get the ball rolling.
Well, I'm just going to push you one last time on that bit then. So, because I think this is a really good practical kind of element of the podcast for people. So if you're having sexual issues in your relationship, one of you or both of you are not happy, how do you start that conversation? So you say, do it non-defensively. Are we talking about planning a time and a day? And are we preceding the conversation, or are we just casually mentioning it as we're loading the dishwasher? What are we doing?
Well, One thing that you mentioned, Kate, that's interesting that I hadn't thought of in this conversation is how about just initiating sex? You know, so many couples are in desire discrepant relationships. How about just showing some desire, initiating? And sometimes, you know, what I'll often hear, let's just say from the male partner is, you know, I feel all this desire. I still find my wife, you know, so sexy and so attractive. But every time I try, I get rejected. So now I've stopped trying and I just wait for her to start to try, which is kind of ridiculous because she may be in a responsive desire framework and may not even be really thinking about sex in the way that he is. But I might say to a female partner, if you don't feel desire, what is your motivation to have sex, right? If you don't feel desire, find a reason, find motivation, because sex is important, because I care about my partner, because I know once I'm having it, it's going to be good, because it's an important part of a relationship, because my partner will be less grumpy if we have it and will show up. You know, if you don't have desire, find your reason, find your motivation. And that's the first thing that I would say is if you're in the position of being able to initiate versus having a conversation, I might say go for the initiation and go for the actual sex itself.
Yeah. I mean, oh, that's brilliant advice, isn't it? Maybe that's just a female response from me. Talk about it first. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, talking in relationships is really important. And we talk about our kids, we talk about our real estate, we talk about our families, but we just don't talk about sex. And so there's no way around it. If it's a conversation that you haven't had, you better start having it. And if you can't just initiate sex and you want to have the conversation, then hey, propose something. You know, I think we should get back to prioritizing sex. I think we should have it once a week. I think we should make it a ritual. I miss it. I feel a little lonely. I feel a little neglected. I feel a little rejected. Whatever the primary emotion is, invite your partner into the conversation.
That's good advice, Ian. Thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find out more about you?
Just on my website, iankerner.com.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, we'll put that in the show notes as well. But Ian Kerner, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you very much for joining me. And thank you, everybody, for listening.